Accession number 30389, reel 6.
In charge of this one block where he was. And I went to give him his medication about 9 o'clock, and he said, I don't feel very well and I think I've had enough of this. And I said, come on, take your medication, you'll soon be asleep, blah, blah, blah. And I left him for a couple of minutes and went back in to see if he'd taken it. And he said, I'm sorry, nurse, I've slit my throat. And in the 2 minutes I'd gone out, he'd got a razor blade and he'd gone like that and stabbed the jugular vein. And there was blood all over the place. It was just horrendous. So I grabbed the first thing I could, which was his towel from his locker, and put pressure on it. And there was an old man, a dirty old man, in one of the beds opposite. And you had to try and keep all this ever so quiet. I mean, this was dreadful. But I rang an emergency bell and this nurse came from the other side. And we went and got the trays and all the packing and everything, because we had to stem the bleeding. We did all this and we were working frantically behind a screen trying to save this man. And then when everything was... he had to go back to the general hospital, of course, because we were just a convalescent place. And so he was taken back to the hospital to be sutured and everything, and he did survive. But when the other nurse went with him in the ambulance and I stayed, and I had to take all the bedding and everything off this bed and take it into a bath in the bathroom, and I covered it all with the... you know, put it all in cold water, blankets and the whole lot, and covered it over with a huge cloth, you know, so that nobody could see it, because the patients who were ambulant used to go in there to shave in the morning. And when I'd got this bed all stripped and washed down and started to make up this old boy, he whistled and I looked over him and he went, nobody was supposed to know what happened. And I just said, go to sleep. And went out again, all professional. But the next morning, of course, because there was this bath full of... we couldn't do it in front of the patients. We had to leave it in soak. And the patients had been in that with their shaving things. And I'd just started to make a start on this. I'd taken the top off and I was trying to sluice all these things. And a man that had forgotten his shaving brush or something came in the bathroom and he went, oh, my God, it looks as if somebody's cut their throat. He didn't know. He'd got no idea. So that was a story from Front Lane. And I stayed there. I think I was there 9 years altogether. And then in the meantime, I'd got my three daughters. They all went to school. And lucky old thing, they all got scholarships. And the reason I said that Susan couldn't remember anything about Buckingham Palace. Susan didn't get a direct entry to the Maidstone Grammar School. She had to have an interview. So she had to go before the Board of Governors to be personally questioned to see if she could get in. And one of the things that they asked her was, can you think of a very memorable thing in your life? And she was only 11. And she said, I can remember going to Buckingham Palace when my daddy got a medal. I don't know what questions they asked her or anything, but she got into the grammar school, and I'm sure it was because of that. Or because she was able to explain it or whatever, but that tipped her in favour. So all the three of them went to grammar schools. They did very well. Two of them went nursing afterwards. None of them went to university. Susan and the youngest one, Mary, wanted to do nursing. And they, of course, qualified properly. They stayed and then they did their midwifery. And they nursed all over the world, I could say, because Susan went to Canada and then she went as a nursing sister on the Queen Elizabeth. The youngest one did the same. She went out to Libya and nursed in a clinic over there. So they've had a very wide experience. And my middle daughter finished up in banking because she wouldn't go nursing. She became a bank manager, so I suppose they did quite well. And then when Dennis retired, he'd been to the police training school and we liked it here, so when he retired from Rochester we came down here and bought a house. And after a while, I must tell you one thing which isn't really for general publication, but my middle daughter, the banker, had a baby, 22, not married. Was going to have adopted, and we went through all the usual adoption societies, welfare, the lot. And then when it came to it, of course, and she had this baby girl, it was when they come to take the baby and all this thing, which tore me to pieces. And Dennis had gone away on a seminar, and I went into hospital to see her. We hadn't told anybody about this baby, that she was pregnant. We kept it very quiet, because it was just a one-off Christmas party thing, I think. Never did get to the bottom of it. And I went to see her on my own in the hospital, and she said, "I don't know what to do because I can't part with this baby." And I said, "I didn't think you would, you know, when the time came." And she said, "What am I going to do?" He had just retired from the police. And what we were going to do with our retirement was nobody's business. And then this blow. So I said, "Well, I will do what I can to help you, but of course I can't speak for your father. You've got to talk to him." And so when he came home from this seminar, I told him about it, and he said, "This isn't on. This is folly, absolute folly. You are nearly 50 years old." He said, "We're just starting a new phase in our life, and there is no way that you're going to take on a baby." So I said, "All right, but you will have to tell her. I can't." So we went over to the hospital together, and we had the same heartbreaking scene. And, please, Daddy, I'll do anything, 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 but please let me keep her." So the top and bottom of it was that I had her. She wouldn't let us adopt her. She wouldn't do that. But we had her for 4.5 years. So in effect, she was mine, and she was the joy of our life, wasn't she? Absolutely. She really was. I had a little Fiat of my own, and I had a car seat put in it for her, and I used to take her all over the place. And I was in inner wheel then, you know, the female of Rotary, and I had lots of friends, and wherever I went, she went, and it was just wonderful. And then when Claire was 3.5, I suppose, Wendy met another chap that had just come home after 15 years abroad, and they married a year later, and they'd bought a house, and they went off on honeymoon, and I had to, and they'd been moving bits and pieces into this house before they went, but when they came back on the day from their honeymoon, I had to have the rest of Claire's bits already, and they took Claire and the bits. 4.5 years. So that was a bit devastating, and I said to Dennis, "I don't know what I'm going to do." And then in the paper that evening, they were advertising for a nurse as with the nuns again. And so I said, "Oh, I think I'll do that if it's all right with you." And I applied and went to see them. And they didn't even bother to take up references. I gave them references of my training school and things like that. They didn't even take them up, and I started the following week. And I worked with the nuns. And then the nuns were all old. They were all trained nurses, but they were old, and they'd let things slide. And going back onto religion, I learned more about God working with them than I ever knew before, because the things they used to do were just quite unbelievable from a nurse's point of view. For instance, there was the Reverend Mother, was the matron, of course, always had the drug cupboard keys. No one else was allowed the drug cupboard keys.
Do you think you should say that?
Pardon?
Do you think you should say that?
Yes.
Now you can delete it.
Pardon? You can take it out, can't you?
All right.
But that's the policeman in him coming out. But she used to come around every morning to take the drugs out of the drug cupboard and put them in matchboxes on the top of the drug cupboard so that the sisters had access to them, but they couldn't open the drug cupboard. That's what I mean about they were way off beam. Scrupulously clean on the wards. They used to do all the cleaning as well as the nurses and me. Whatever they did, I did. And then, the first time I was asked to go into the theatre with one of the nuns, I went in, and it was a typical operating theatre, but there was a gully along the side of the theatre, so that when you swirled the floor afterwards, it all went into this gully. And when I went in this first day into this theatre to get ready for this case, this gully was level with cobwebs. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe what I saw. And yet in all the years that I was there with the nuns, which was 3 years, I think, with the nuns, we never had one case of infection. Not one. This is faith again, you know. And then because they were the renewal of their licence was in jeopardy because they were getting no new nuns into the order, and so they were going to have to change the thing altogether, because I was a trained nurse and there were one or two others, but just relieved, you know. And so there was a committee that ran the place, and it was like a retired admiral and Sir Thomas Rapp was a retired diplomat, all these people, and they ran the hospital, and so they decided that the nuns would have to go. It would have to be closed down and then reopened, you know, with a whole new setup. And so they came to me and said, told me what was going to happen, and said, would I be prepared to stay on till the, because I said I would go when the nuns did, and because there was a lot in the newspapers at the time, it was quite an unpleasant period, and I said, no, when the nuns go, I'll go. But this Sir Thomas Rapp and Mr. Thomas, I think, came to see me, and they said, would I stay at least until the hospital got on its feet and to help to get it ready? And I agreed to do that. And we also had a vicar, a canon's wife, who used to work part-time as a nurse there, and the new matron, and there was one other, and I can't picture her at the moment. But we went and we took the hospital over after the nuns had gone, and we cleaned it from top to bottom, sterilised it, did everything. no need to do it, but we did, because we wanted to see it carry on and succeed. And so we cleaned it and we cleared out cupboards with ancient medicines, and it was just truly unbelievable. It's an experience again. And then I think we opened up for business a few weeks or so afterwards, and the new matron asked me if I would go permanently in the theatre. And I said, yes, I would. So I went in the theatre. So I was at St. Saviour's for 10 years. And I loved that too. And that was because I'd lost Claire, you see. And I worked there until I was 64. So that wasn't bad, was it? And I retired when I was 64. That was a nice period. And stood me in good stead, because I knew all the surgeons and all the anaesthetists, and you know, that if I wanted anything, I could go and ask, and I still know them, of course, but like me now, they're retired, a lot of them. So more or less, that was the nursing life. And 24 years on from there, I'm still here. I don't know why.
Yes, you do, because your time hasn't come.
That's what he keeps saying. You won't go till your time comes. But I think you should, if you want to.
On the nursing side of things, going back a little bit, what effect did the advent of the National Health Service have?
We were all stunned, I should say, that this had actually happened, because when I did my training, it was a voluntary hospital. It was called a voluntary hospital, and we used to have flag days and fairs, you know, to raise money. And I've actually got a picture of me with another nurse, with our uniforms and our capes with the crosses across the front, along the seafront at Cleethorpes with charity boxes. We used to go out collecting. So I was not actually nursing when the National Health Service came in. But I couldn't believe that you could go to a doctor and not have to pay. Because we used to pay to go and see the doctor. And we used to, if you had a home visit, at the time that I'm thinking about, we used to pay 7 and 6 pence for a home visit. But we also, everyone that was working, paid a penny a week out of their salary to the hospital. So that's how it was maintained to some extent in those days, by voluntary contributions. And I don't remember much about, the debate about the National Health Service. I only know that it was a shock to nurses to suddenly realise that everything was free. That's what I remember about that. And then it's taken for granted, then it's abused, and then you're almost back to square one, aren't you? My daughters and I talk about it sometimes, and my oldest daughter, who now, of course, is retired, she used to say to me, "Mum, it will go full circle, it has to." You know, meaning that we should go get rid of the salmon and go back to the basics that we were taught. She said it's got to. Because you read, don't you, about the neglect of patients and MRS drug or whatever it is that's around. We never had that sort of infection. And visitors used to come in and sit on beds. I mean, all the things that they're trying to prohibit now went on without all these bugs, because we were trained to clean things, you know, and everything was spotless. Everything that we used was spotless, and we used to use all the disinfectants, and Lysol was a great thing, you know. Lysol was one of the things that we used to use, which killed everything stone dead. So I don't quite know what's happened to it all, really. When I heard of all these bugs hitting hospital, I couldn't afford it, believe it. But then, when you think of the way the hospitals are run now, with these, most of them are part-time, and another thing that bugs me is seeing nurses out in uniform. We'd have been hung, drawn and quartered if we'd gone out of the hospital in a uniform. Because you're going out, you're taking bugs out, you're bringing bugs in. And yet I see people in Sainsbury's and Waitrose and places like that in uniform. Why? They shouldn't be. But it's silly things like that seem to have gone by the board when they're looking for explanations to the influx of these bacteria. And again, I think it's probably because I'm old-fashioned, but Susan, my oldest daughter, will say just the same. Can you believe that they go out in uniform? We had lockers, and that's where our uniforms were. We never went out in uniform. We'd have been killed. But you see, all that is, I don't know enough about nursing now to be able to speak with any authority on it. It's only what you see, and when you see nurses, you know, with a cardigan over their uniform and going in and out of shops and then going back on duty, they're not going back to change into a different uniform, and you think, my God, this is so different from what it was. And then you talk to patients that have come out of hospital and been in hospital, and they tell you of the things that have happened, and it's horrendous. It's horrendous. I mean, I've had four lots of major surgery, in as much as I've had both my hips replaced and both my knees replaced. And I consider myself very, very fortunate, because I knew the surgeons and I knew the anaesthetists. So I think I had special care, if you like. Not noticeably over the top, but I think because they knew who I was, I could be exaggerating that, but I was able to communicate with them and tell them how I felt and where the pain was and all this sort of thing. But some of the things that I saw when I was a patient in there horrified me, from the cleaning aspect, from the nursing aspect. I couldn't believe it. There were a few really dedicated, you know, that obviously loved their job. This is what you need to do in a job like that. You've got to love what you're doing. But so much of it now is mechanical. You don't have the same contact with the patient as you did. There's too much machinery. You must have seen this on programs of, you know, sticking this in there and that in there. And they come round, you know, with this thing to do your pulse and your blood pressure and all that sort of thing. You don't have contact with the patient. Do you know what I'm trying to say? I mean, in the old days, you put a thermometer in the mouth and you had your hand on this to check the pulse and you watched their breathing. That was personal contact with the patient, which I'm sure worked wonders for the patient. Now these kids come along with a machine and they stick this in there and they do that in there and then they wheel the machine off to the next patient. I used to feel ever so sorry for some of these patients. I used to want to get out and go and do something. There was a lady in the bed next to me when I was having one of my knees done. And she told me that they didn't know what was the matter with her, but she was desperately ill. And I used to feel heart sick, you know. I'm not saying that nothing was being done. There was probably all sorts of tests being carried out. But she wasn't obviously being kept in the picture, and it's so important. If people know what's happening to them and what's going to happen to them, they're much more likely to accept the situation. But people are not told things anymore. I don't know. I was told, no, I have to think how long ago, 2 years ago. When did you go to New Zealand? 3 years ago?
2 years.
Whenever. He was going to New Zealand and I'd had these knees done, so there was no way I was going to make that trip. And just before he went, I discovered a lump in my breast. And I thought, now if I say anything, he won't go, so we'll sit on that one. So he had his holiday and he came back, and after he'd been back for a little while, I said to him, I've got a lump in my breast, so I'm going to have to see what it is. So I went to see my doctor, and he referred me to a surgeon, William Harvey, and I went. And again, this is why I say when you know them, it's so different. And this was a man that I'd worked with. And, what are you doing here kind of thing, you know. Anyway, he had examined me and he said, oh dear. Right, he said, we'll have to have that out. And then you'll have to have chemotherapy. So I said, thank you very much. And I have to say that with breast cancer, they're very quick with you. And so I went in and I had this lump removed. And then he said, and what they often do, usually do, when they remove the lump, they remove glands from under the arm. So I said to him, you can have the lump, but I'll keep the glands, because I've seen the results of all this. So he said, you're very silly. I said, never mind, we'll take a chance on it. So he removed the lump, and he said to me, I want to see you, sir. And I'll arrange radiotherapy for you. I said, no, you won't. So he said, come on now, what are we talking about? So I said, I'm 80 years old, and I'm not putting myself through all that. I've had a good life. I don't regret any of it, but I'm not putting myself through all that. So he said, well, I think you're very silly, Parky, but I can't force you to do anything. So he said, off you go, and I'll see you in 6 months. And they put me on a drug called tamoxifen, which I took. So after 6 months, I went back to see him, and he said, everything's fine. So I said, good. So 6 months after that, I went again for another checkup, and he said, uh-oh, got another lump under your arm. So I said, I see. So he said, it's got to come out, and we've got to have the radiotherapy this time. I said, it's not coming out, and I'm not having radiotherapy. I shall put my faith in God, because I am now 87 years old. So I'm just ignoring it, taking my chances. So that's where we are at the moment. So I've got cancer, I've refused all treatment, and they're keeping an eye on me. And they changed my drug from tamoxifen to something called Arimidex, and I am convinced that it's reduced, not reduced it necessarily, but stopped it growing. I'm pretty sure. And I feel quite good. And I saw the surgeon a couple of weeks ago, 3 weeks ago. And I didn't see the surgeon because he's now retired, so I saw his registrar. And he said, why did you refuse treatment? And he asked me, and I said, because of my age. I said, this is absolutely silly. In my book, I'm 88 years old. I don't want to put myself through the trauma of the treatment. I don't mind the surgery, because you get over that pretty quickly, but I can't be trailing to Canterbury, you know, two or three times a week for radio treatment and then coming back and feeling like death. As long as I feel all right, I shall carry on. And he was a young chap, a younger fellow, and he said, I can't understand you. And I said, if If I was 30 years younger, maybe I'd say, fine, go ahead, but not at my time of life. He said, you're a very positive lady, aren't you? And I said, well, I try to be. So he said, well, I shall see you again in 3 months. So that's my situation at the moment. But I'm not unhappy about it. I mean, when you see these patients that have the treatment and that, and they deteriorate, some, not all, but some deteriorate so quickly. And I'm still active and able to get about, sometimes with difficulty, but I do. And I've got no pain or anything like that. So we never know when the day might come.
You mentioned this at, sort of touched on it a bit just at the beginning of your nursing career, but what effect did the experiences of nursing have on your opinion of social attitudes?
There was ever such a lot of respect for nurses when I was nursing. When I trained, you felt proud because the patients did love you. They really did, and I mean, you were respected everywhere. And I found that when I worked at Fant Lane, there was the same feeling. At most of the places I've worked, the nurses were very, very highly thought of. I still respect them. I don't have the same feeling for them, having seen them working with me as the patient, you know, on the other side of the bed kind of thing. I resent the fact that they don't have the human touch. And people notice this in patients. They feel in the way in hospital. That's dreadful. And they're frightened, especially with all this thing about the drugs and, you know, the bugs and things that are about. And people are not treated very kindly, I don't think, and in a lot of cases with respect. I truly believe that, and I have had 4 sessions, 5 with the breast in hospital. I have no complaints whatsoever. The treatment I had was good and efficient. But you see, I have some experience of the job. What about these people that have no idea what they're letting themselves in for? I think on the whole, I don't know, I can't truthfully say about the feelings for today, although I do find when you're talking to people, if you haven't, you know, if you've someone you've recently met, and they say, and you say, it comes up that you had been a nurse. Oh, really? That kind of, oh, you know, so there is some respect, I think, for nurses, generally. And the men, of course, love them. And the men fall for the night nurses. And the day nurses, I suppose. I think it's a highly respected profession, and my mother did it, as I say, and she was in the days of the Florence Nightingale, you know, and the beautiful uniform that they used to wear. That's why I said I felt a lot of sympathy for her as I've grown older, knowing the kind of work she did in big private houses in Grimsby, and then to come on waiting the same people at table with her. But yes, I think nurses are respected.